Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Host at 7 o'clock. Right now, on this day back in 1887, the Star newspaper would be published for the first time in Johannesburg. Interestingly enough, the newspaper would have been founded in January of 1871, just a couple of years prior to that. But it would have been published for the first time under the name the Eastern Star in Johannesburg on this day. In 1888, Thomas Edison would file for a patent for the optical phonograph. That would be, of course, the first movie. In 1904, on this day, a gentleman by the name of Amedeo Giannini would open the Bank of Italy in San Francisco. That would later become known as the Bank of America. 1933, on this day, Albert Einstein would land in the United States as a refugee from Nazi Germany. In 1957, on this day, Jailhouse Rock, the musical film, would premiere in Memphis. Obviously, the life of Elvis Presley there. In 1959, Queen Elizabeth would be fined $140 for withdrawing her racehorse from a race. I wonder who was brave enough to fine the Queen. In 1979, on this day, Mother Teresa would receive a Nobel Prize. In 1981, Nelson Piquet would take his first ever Drivers' Championship title by 1 point. 1988, a company called Philip Morris would decide it wants to buy a company called Kraft for $11 billion. Yes, in 1988, they did have billions involved there. The deal would go through later in the month of October, but it wouldn't go through for $11 billion. It would go through for $13.1 billion. They couldn't let the $2 billion go. In 2005, on this day, Thierry Henry would be the all-time goal scorer at Arsenal. In 2015, on the exact same day, 10 years later, Cristiano Ronaldo would achieve the same feat at Real Madrid. And in 2017, on this day, George Soros would announce that he had donated $18 billion to his Open Society Foundations. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at Zando's closure. The parent company of Zando, Jumia Group, has decided they are closing down the Zando online platform, and they are doing it in South Africa. They're also doing it in Tunisia because it simply isn't profitable. We're going to speak to Jumia and find out why they say it's not profitable and whether or not there's a value in the e-commerce space. Then we've got a conversation with the Center for Development and Enterprise around the latest report they've put out that suggests that state-owned entities could benefit from having competition in their various sectors. Then we've got a conversation with PSG, that is PSG Financial Services, listed on the JSE, around their six-month update for the half year that started and ended August 2024. And then, because it's Thursday, we've got an SME. We're going to be taking a look at a company called Freshmo Brands. I'm joined by the company's founder and CEO, Paul Masilo, and he's going to tell us what the business is about.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
You know the drill by now. We kick off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day and what the markets are could potentially be thinking at this stage, I suppose, depending on who you ask. I'm joined on the line by Senior Portfolio Manager at F&B Wealth and Investments, someone we haven't spoken to in quite some time, Wayne McCurry, to take a look at the market movements and try and understand them. Good evening, Wayne. Lovely to speak to you again. It's been a while. Second straight consecutive day of bullish movement on the resources sector. I don't want to say it, I don't want to jinx it, but good close to the week?
Well, we hope so. I mean, the mining shares were really, really strong today. They were up 3.5%, driven mainly by gold shares. I mean, DRD came out with their results, which were very, very good. And I think that obviously coupled with the actual gold price in dollars and a little bit of rand weakness over the last few days have pushed the gold shares up. But some of the other mining shares, particularly Anglo American, were also up quite strongly. There are rumors going around that BHP Billiton may now make another bid. Remember, they bid for Anglo 6 months ago and they've got to wait 6 months before they do another bid. I mean, and I stress, these are just rumors. There's nothing out. But certainly Anglo's was up 3%, Billiton was down 2.5% on the day. So I think some influence in the share prices to these rumors. We'll have to see what happens, of course. But yeah, the mining shares have actually been strong 2 days in a row now.
Wayne, you bring up the gold price, and I had a look at it. We're clearly on a very clear path to touch more than $2,700 an ounce, and that could only be that could only mean that gold miners and mining companies are laughing all the way to the bank. They're not going to complain about this price.
No, they won't. But understand, they've also had to, you know, deal with this, where the South African producers, okay, look, there's not much gold being produced in South Africa at the moment. And they've had to deal with the stronger rand. But yeah, the gold price has been fantastic. You know, up until very recently, even with the high gold price, the gold miners didn't show a massive increase in their profitability. Their profitability was actually a little bit wanting, in my view. You wouldn't have expected their profits to stay more or less stable and not go up sharply, but certainly the DRD one, profits are up sharply. So maybe they've reached some sort of marginal level now where the extra gold price just falls to their bottom line. They'll also increase production, because when the price is so high, you make hay while the sun shines, you produce as much gold as what you possibly can to sell into the market. But a word of caution, you know, the gold price can fall just as fast as what it goes up, because that's what's happened every single time in the past. You know, gold gives you this fantastic run once every 5 or 6 or 7 years, and everything looks just beautiful. I mean, couldn't get better. And the problem is it doesn't get better and the price collapses thereafter. So this time may be different, who knows? But that's the history of gold. It's very volatile. You've got to be cautious.
Wayne, what's to be said about platinum pricing? I mean, that's been struggling along, and the platinum basket has been going through the most, and we're finally back above $1,000. We've been teetering on either side of this $1,000 level. Is it the same in the case of the PGM basket or the platinum pricing that platinum miners are still concerned about it at the moment?
Yes, platinum miners essentially aren't making money at these levels. But it's a very normal cycle, and I stress that every time people ask me about it. This happens regularly to all mining shares other than gold, and you could argue it happens to gold as well, but let's just talk straight industrial commodity type of mining shares. You know, you get the up cycle and you get the down cycle. And at the moment, we're in the down cycle quite clearly on platinum and palladium. You know, even though they have bounced off the $900 and they're now above $1,000, the share prices haven't really done anything yet. But when you look at the overall environment, there are some positives for the platinum miners. Firstly, they're going to cut production because they're not making money. So all of their marginal shafts, etc., operations, they're going to cut production. That'll help the price. Secondly, there's a forecast deficit for platinum and palladium going forward, so that'll also help the price. Thirdly, the offtake of electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles, has stalled, and has stalled quite dramatically. And hybrids are going up. That's very good for PGMs and for the use in auto catalysts. And then when you listen to the executives of the mining companies, they all say this is a cyclical downturn. They see no real dent in demand for their product over the next, you know, medium term, 3 to 5 years. Who knows what will happen after that? But I think it's just a normal cycle. And exactly the same thing happened in the late 90s. You know, no one wanted to touch platinum. And yet for the next 6 years after that, it was the best performing sector on the market by far. I mean, this was the NVIDIA, the platinum shares were the NVIDIAs of the day. You know, so, you know, be aware of a cycle.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that cycle. In the meantime, I want to come back to the Anglo story. You said something very interesting about the fact that, yes, it is still rumors at this stage, but BHP could potentially be interested once again. And I want to get your thoughts on that, Wayne. At what price does that deal make sense?
Well, that's the big question. Is it how much is BHP prepared to pay to get those copper assets? Because they'll also unbundle the Beers, they'll also unbundle Amplats. They may even unbundle Kumba. I mean, who knows? They want the copper assets. And the reason why they want it is that since 2015, mining companies have spent virtually no capital expenditure at all. I mean, they were all bankrupt in 2015 almost. Almost, you know, a good few of them had to pass their dividends and their balance sheets were in terrible condition. And they haven't spent CapEx. So, you know, with falling interest rates globally, you could get some increase in demand. Hopefully China also picks up a little bit. And there's no real new supply to meet that. I mean, there's no big copper mine or iron ore mine that's been opened over the last, you know, 7-8 years. So they want those assets. So it's just a question of how much are they going to pay for them. And, you know, they are, even though the Anglo share price has gone up, you know, it's off the bottoms. You know, in the bigger scheme of things, this is the time to buy when you're at the bottom of the commodity cycle, or maybe the commodity cycle is now finally, after many years, going to turn up on the back of lower global interest rates. So if you want to buy, now's the time to buy. Previously, all the big transactions were done at the top of the cycle, and if you think back to 2008, how many incredibly poor capital allocation decisions were made at that stage. Spent a lot of money and then really suffered for the next decade, essentially. So we'll see what they're prepared to pay for it. But, you know, these are the only real big copper assets available, you know. And if you want it, you may have to pay, because, you know, the Anglo shareholders rejected the last deal, and, you know, they'll reject the first offer if it comes as well, because that's how you start negotiating. So they may have to pay up quite substantially more to actually secure those assets, because ultimately the shareholders vote, it's not management that votes.
At the risk of sounding like a simpleton, Wayne, why not just then have a sit down with management and say, we don't want to buy the whole Anglo business, just give us a valuation on the copper business, we'll pay you an outrageous premium on the copper business, unbundle it that way, and then we all move on.
Well, essentially that's what Anglo's is going to be, it's just a copper play. I mean, Anglo's management themselves, they're keeping their crop nutritional business in the UK, they're keeping Kumba, but these are small businesses in relation to their copper assets. So essentially buying Anglo's, you are just buying copper. There's, you know, once they've unbundled the Beers and Amplats, it's not really that much left. I don't quite understand why they want to keep the fertilizer business in the UK. I think it might be more pride than anything else. But Kumba and that crop nutritional business and the other businesses are small cheese in relation to copper once they've unbundled the Beers and Amplats.
Well, when that deal does eventually go through, we're going to definitely sit down again together, Wayne, and discuss whether or not it makes sense. But for now, we've run out of time. Thank you, as always, for the time and for the insights. Wayne McCurry, Senior Portfolio Manager at F&B Wealth and Investments, on market movements today and what rumors might be circulating around the water cooler.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Ready to take control of your financial future? Moneyversity Plus is your go-to streaming edutainment platform for all ages. With fun, engaging content and downloads for kids ages 6 to 17 and practical lessons for adults of all ages, Moneyversity Plus makes learning about money easy and exciting for everyone in the family. Plus, as you learn, you can earn Old Mutual Rewards points, a win for your wallet and a win for your future. Whether it's mastering money basics or planning your financial goals, Moneyversity has you covered. Start streaming today and join thousands of others at moneyversity.co.za. Your plus one for financial wisdom.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Zando, the online platform that we've known for many, many years in South Africa, has decided to close up a shop, not necessarily Zando directly, but the company that owns Zando, that is the Jumia Group, listed in New York on the stock exchange on that side. I'm joined on the line by the Jumia Group's VP for Communications and Public Relations, Abdisalem Benzitoni, to take a look at this and try and understand the rationale behind this decision. Abdisalem, thanks so much for taking the time. The business has been operational in South Africa for the last 10 years, and the decision to close up shop at this stage is certainly one that is surprising to many, I'd imagine, but the business has done a thorough analysis around why closing up now is the right time. Can you just shed some light around the thought process and why the decision has been taken?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me first. It was a bit sad decision for us, but it came from the board management, actually. I mean, for the management, after a review of all our operations, all the resources, the capital, you know, and we decided to cease operations in South Africa and to focus on the strategic market. This gives us also, you know, it's a way to optimize our resources and focus on markets with strong growth potentials. Zando in South Africa is very specific market for us because even the name is different from Jumia. And fashion, it's also very unique because it's only in Zando. In Jumia, we have fashion, but we have all the category from e-commerce. And we decided, if you check the context of fashions across the world, the trend is, there is a crisis around fashion in the world. Like all the fashion companies are a bit suffering about this trend. And for us, it was really like, you know, today, like if I give you some data to understand the business of Zando in Jumia for 2023, and even for the 6 months of 2024, Zando accounted for only 3.5% of all the total orders and 4.5% of the GMV. So it's a very small for us. It's very small at Jumia as a group. So for us, we want really to focus on the growth market, a promising market like Nigeria, Kenya, Ivory Coast, Morocco, where we can see a lot of potential and a lot of growth.
Abdusalam, the Zando site currently has a sale on saying that everything is going to be cleared out and whatever stock is on hand, I imagine, would then be sold off, hopefully, in an effort to just exit the business or exit the region. What happens in that event? What happens to those that purchase products? Is there going to be continued support? Is there going to be some form of after-sales service that will continue from the Jumia business within the markets that you've chosen to exit?
Yeah, definitely we're not going to close doors today, tomorrow. We're going to cease operation by end of the year. So it means we're doing clearance right now. So we have great offers. Until end of the year, we're going to operate. So the operations will be on the 31st of December, the latest. But yeah, there is all the orders will be down. You can also, use Zando until end of December. We have clearance now, so great deals as well. And of course, for the team, we're going to work. We're going to relocate some people because we have central operations. So we want really to do it well. And also, it's not easy to leave a country. We can do it now because we have raised money recently. So that's why we are more in comfortable situations to do it and to focus on our markets. You have to take the tough decision right now when you have the money, you have everything, and you have really to focus how can you grow. We are a private company. We want also to accelerate our path to profitability. And we want really to focus on the countries where we can grow very quickly and scale up. That's why we're investing in those countries. In Nigeria, we opened a new warehouses. In Ivory Coast and Egypt, we're going to open new warehouses. So it's just like refocusing on strategic markets.
Certainly sad news indeed, but a business must do what is necessary to continue moving forward. We'll leave it at that. Abdusalam, thanks so much for the insights. That's Abdusalam Benzetoni, who is the VP for Communications and Public Relations at the Jumia Group on Zando's decision to exit South Africa and the Tunisian market. I'm now joined on the line by Mudiwa Gavaza, economist at Business Day, to share his thoughts and reflections around this latest announcement. Good evening, Mudiwa. Always lovely to speak to you. The Zando team, the Jumia family, has basically said that Zando in South Africa is a negligible portion of their business. It only adds about 3.5% to their overall operation. Your thoughts on this?
I guess at some point you have to think about rationalizing. So, yeah. Good evening, Jimmy. It's a tough one, and I was listening to what the gentleman had to say. I guess it makes business sense for them. And if you are accounting for such a small piece of the business, then I guess you have to go, where the returns are. I think it's also reflective of the size of the African market when it comes to e-commerce, because if you think about it, South Africa has one of the most developed sets of infrastructure when it comes to e-commerce. Let's talk logistics, let's talk payments, let's talk competition. I would also, parse some of it towards, the size of the pie that Ozando likely had in the market. I think we've also seen what's happened with the likes of, Superbalist, the entry of the two Chinese players, Timu Shane, does a lot, to reduce the attractiveness of the space. So I do think it does make sense. It's a bit sad. Strategically, if I was a business that had deep enough pools of capital, I would have kept that running, because South Africa is such a developed economy, and strategically I think it makes sense to have a presence in South Africa. But if you are under pressure for the returns, like what the Zando team has indicated, and you're raising these rounds of funding, and people capital isn't as patient as it's been in the past, so it would make sense from that point of view.
I was actually going to get into the e-commerce side of it, Madiwa, to say that we're seeing the likes of Amazon come here. We've seen Shein and Temu, as you've alluded to, both operating and setting up in South Africa. South Africa is no stranger to the online kind of space, Takealot and all of that. And Zando is a name that's been around for 10 years. Surely you would think it would have some brand recognition within the South African market. Did they just lose the plot somewhere and just slip from the minds of South African consumers, and now it's difficult to get back?
I think I would proffer two things. The first one, an extension of what I was saying earlier on about the size of that e-commerce pie that we're talking about, especially when it comes to retail type of businesses. You're looking at 4 or 5% of the total pie. It's a big piece of business. I think the data that we have from the likes of Worldwide Works say you're looking at a 70 or so billion rand market currently. And that's a big number, but how sustainable is it to have a number of different players? Because the one thing that is quite evident is the fact that there's a lot of competition in the space. So 70 billion, it's great, but your 70 billion is likely going to lean more towards some of the bigger players. You've got time in the market, you've got a recognizable brand, but your ability to withstand those shocks when you have increased competition are tough. And if you see your biggest e-commerce player like a Takealot selling off a Superbalist because the competitive environment has become that untenable, that also shows you how tough it is to operate in the market. I think, and then the second piece I would just throw in there is, we likely need to do a little bit more to push up the rate of e-commerce adoption, especially on the retail side. I think when we get to about 10 or 15% of total retail, that will be the type of market where we can have so many multiple players. Otherwise, you continue to play this, can I call it a race to the bottom? Because if Shein and Tain have done, and Timo have done anything, it's to drive a lot of prices down. And we're seeing that pushback right now from the local retailers to say, hey, guys, we're finding this very hard to compete with. If you have big institutions such as a Takealot, but even your traditional players like a TFG, etc., complaining about what's going on with these guys, imagine being a smaller player that's only relying on that small slice of what's happening in e-commerce. So I think we need to find ways to grow the market, and then I think that will help us to have this diversity of players. What I'm afraid of is that we might see one or two more closures and then see a little bit more concentration being in the hands of a few players. That would not be good for the market.
The race to zero versus the race against survival. That's quite an interesting prospect there. I think it certainly does lend itself to affecting the consumer, as we are the ones that ultimately determine whether or not we want to go for the quick, cheaper alternatives or the brands that we've known and loved. I think we'll leave it at that, Modiwa. Thanks for the time and for the insights. Modiwa Gavaza, economist at Business Day, joining me to reflect on the decision made by Zando and its parent company to exit South Africa as well as exit Tunisia.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So the Center for Development and Enterprise released a report around state-owned entities, and it suggests that introducing competition would help state-owned entities perform better. No surprises there, but I am joined on the line by the CDE's Executive Director and Head, Anne Bernstein, to take a look at this and try and make sense of this. Good evening, and thanks as always for the time. Let's start with an overview of the report. Action 6 was a very detailed report, but just give us a summary around the thinking there and why putting the report together was so important.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Great to be with you. Late last year, CDE decided that the most important thing we could do in 2024 was to think deep and hard about the key priority actions for the new government we elected in May this year. And our thinking was, what were the immediate things that could make a big difference? South Africa has so many challenges and so many areas with things are going wrong, that we wanted to identify the catalytic actions that would send bold signals of change and fundamental change, that the seventh administration, the GNU, was going to be really different from what's gone before. So that's the context for this. We're on our sixth report. There are probably 10 or 11, possibly, and we're bringing them out. We've chosen five areas to focus on, and then within each area, we're picking up the catalytic areas for immediate action. And so the whole question of South Africa's fiscal crisis and economic growth has been two of our key themes of work. And so this report on the SOEs and what to do about them is a part of that. So we're heading towards the medium-term budget statement. And in the meanwhile, we're saying that we need a much clearer picture and a much more coherent reform program to deal with these enormous entities whose bailouts have absorbed so much of South Africa's money that could have been spent on helping poorer people or making us a more competitive economy.
And I remember when the National State Enterprises Bill came out earlier this year, we also kind of had an indication from the government that there was going to be something called a State Asset Management SOE, a new SOE to control the SOEs and all of those sorts of things. And we're supposed to have 13 SOEs fit into that. That picture kind of really hasn't materialized at this point. And we're kind of sitting with SOEs now having to still report into their respective ministries, but we don't actually have this consolidated oversight. What's the current approach that's being used to reform SOEs in line with this National State Enterprises Bill? It doesn't seem like we're getting much traction there.
Well, the bill is on the table. I think there's real interest in some parts of government in going ahead with this. We don't think this is the best approach. We think it's a diversion. It won't really deal with the fundamental challenges facing our large SOEs. And we're saying that, you know, government's been a bit confused for a while, but now they're saying that the large SOEs will report to their policy departments, they're calling it. And we don't think this is the right approach. It's not the best approach now. And a lot of experts are saying the same thing, that the problem with a policy department, say, managing Eskom or the transport department managing Transnet or them reporting to the Minister of Transport, is that that department gets an interest in keeping this entity and at a time when we need absolutely fundamental reform, which many of the SOEs are resisting. We are saying that the best interim approach is to place the large SOEs under the National Treasury, and that the National Treasury should immediately look at the quality of the boards and senior management of each of these SOEs, especially when it hasn't been looked at in the very near past, and make sure that we have the best possible people to run these entities as they undergo important transitions to help the country, to help them make them much more competitive and to help them be assets for the national economy rather than liabilities. Also saying, in the medium term, what the country really needs is a highly skilled, small team of people, perhaps a department that will manage the state-owned enterprises and do this in a way that is world-class, but with high skills, that really understand competition, private sector financing, leveraging, and a whole lot of other things, as well as delivery, that we're not getting. So that would be a longer-term perspective. But in the short term, we're saying we're not convinced by the route that's being taken, and we would do it differently.
Now, Anne, much has been said around the challenges that face SOEs. We know the challenges. We felt the challenges as South Africans very, very clearly in some cases. And I think what I like about the report especially is the fact that there are recommendations being put forward. I mean, you've just touched on a couple of those recommendations. So the report is not to come to the party without solutions. When we look at these solutions and these recommendations and things that can be put in place to make SOEs more effective and more competitive, how practical are the solutions?
Well, we think they're practical. We think whether they will actually be implemented depends on the GNU. And key parties in the GNU should be pushing for the kinds of recommendations that we are making. But you have to start from what you touched on, but I think people minimize. The fact is that our large NGOs and our large SOEs have been a disaster. Not only have they failed to provide the services the economy needs at prices that are affordable to customers, that are competitive, but they've drawn state resources in the form of bailouts, so they're not economically making it. Financially, many are bankrupt, essentially, and that money, those hundreds of billions of rands, could have been spent elsewhere. So you have to start with how bad things are. And that's the basis of which we are making the recommendations that we've put forward in our document today.
And before I let you go, I remember, I think it was last week, exactly this time last week, in fact, there was a presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation regarding this very National State Enterprises Bill. And I imagine you would have had some idea of what that presentation was. It seems like a lengthy presentation. Does it really get us moving in the right direction? Because the last thing that we want is to be having these conversations with no real way forward. And as you alluded to, implementation seems to be the shortcoming of where our strategy falls flat.
Well, I haven't seen that presentation, but let me make two points. The first is that what we need in the state-owned enterprise sector is much more competition. And it's only competition that is going to get us much better services and cheaper prices. So we're calling very strongly for a competition policy that the state must develop that looks at where should the state be running activities in our economy and why. And if they shouldn't, then they should be moved out of the state-owned sector, number one. Number two, if you want to fix Transnet, for example, we don't just want concessioning to one entity, which is now being delayed. That the entity then buys into the monopoly that is Transnet. We want competition. We want different firms running different ports and seeing who does better with tight contracts. But that's what we're looking for. And that, we think, is the only way to to discipline the state-owned entities and to discipline the companies that are going to start getting involved so that South Africa gets much more efficient services so that our economy has a chance of starting to grow faster again. But Transnet doesn't seem very clear on how they understand competition or the role of the private sector. Not yet.
Competition is never a bad thing, especially if it results in efficiencies. Now one wonders whether or not we'll get to those efficiencies, but until then, we'll hope and pray, I suppose. That's as much as we can do. Thank you so much, Anne, for the time and for the insights. That's Anne Bernstein, who is an executive director and the head of the Center for Development and Enterprise, on their latest report that suggests that SOEs, if given competition, could do better.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Just before lunchtime today, the listed financial services company known as PSG Financial Services decided to give us an update on how they've been performing over the last 6 months. They gave us an update to their first half of the year ended August 2024. I'm joined on the line by PSG's Chief Financial Officer, Mike Smith, to take a look at the company's performance and see where they stand at the moment. Good evening, Mike. Lovely to speak to you as always. Looking good so far. Recurring headline earnings per share up 28%, assets under management approaching that 500 billion rand mark. Really very little to complain about at this stage. How are you finding the first 6 months?
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. I think what we really pleased with is the continued top-line revenue growth that we've seen. The fact that we've been able to double our earnings in the past 4 years, quadruple them in the past 10 years. So, you know, very much focus on the long-term earnings trend. And yeah, please, the wealth business, I mean, the past 5 years has brought in 84 billion of positive net flows, 10.3 in the most recent 6 month period. So, you know, I think a business ability to attract new client assets is a good indication of the caliber and quality of service and products that we're able to offer to our client base.
Mike, how have you been doing it? Because the last 5 years have certainly not been easy from an economic point of view, and there have been a lot of issues that consumers and investors have had to contend with. What's been kind of the trick to getting it right in those challenging times?
So I think it's been the investments that we've made. In the past 10 years, we've invested roughly 3.5 billion rand in IT and infrastructure, all which has been fully expensed. So it's been continuous incremental improvement in client experience, onboarding. I think the quality of new advisors, the new graduates which we've brought into the business and trained as well. So it's been multiple factors that we've focused on and looking at doing something a little bit better every day.
Mike, speaking of continuously improving and doing a little bit more every day, part of the strategy and part of the approach has been to get that repurchase program, the share repurchase program, wrapped up. Just over 11 million shares repurchased and cancelled there. That's obviously unlocking value for investors whilst at the same time the business continues to grow.
Yeah, so it's part of our overall capital optimization. If you look over the past 5 or 6 years, we've bought back about 80 million shares. And, you know, returning cash to shareholders, a combination of dividends, where we've paid out between 40 and 50% of headline earnings, plus the buyback of shares. So, yeah, it's something that we've done, I think, consistently for a number of years.
Speaking of that dividend, you've increased the interim dividend this time around. It's always nice to be able to pay a dividend when you're not under a lot of pressure and you're able to comfortably say, this is in line with our dividend policy. We're not stretching ourselves. We're comfortable to still be able to do this. But also, we can increase it a little from last year.
Yeah, so yeah, we increased our interim dividend by 26%. We generally pay one third as an interim dividend and two thirds as a final dividend. So, yeah, I think we've communicated to the market our dividend policy, and I think, yeah, been able to follow that consistently.
Mike, how are you seeing the landscape shape up? How are you looking into the next half of the year and possibly even going into the new financial year as well? We've come out of a very difficult time. We're finally getting things to a stable point in South Africa and around the world in some respects. How are you seeing the investment landscape shaping up going forward?
Look, a substantial portion of our revenue is linked to the value of our client assets under management. I think our client assets are well diversified across asset classes, both local and offshore there. And I think very much more focused on the longer term. The fact that our starting AUM for this new 6 month period is higher than it was previously would also help the revenue that we'd earn. I think, yeah, it's been positive to see improvements in investor and consumer confidence in South Africa. I think just with a more stable electricity supply and the GNU, some positive initial green shoots.
Mike, what's still concerning with regards to the economic conditions? I mean, we are obviously still going through a bit of a transitionary phase and things aren't all the way where we want them to be. Are there any real areas that might be concerning you as a fund manager, as an asset manager, that whether they're local or international, you might be saying this is giving us a bit of a headache or this is having us a little bit nervous at the moment?
Yeah, so I think what we are going to need to see, you know, is important trade-offs where one looks at implementing certain changes, that there's detailed economic feasibility studies so that one can evaluate, you know, the pros and cons of implementing with the American election. I think there's a risk of them increasing tariffs, particularly would impact China, which is one of our trading partners. So one needs to be aware of a changing macroeconomic environment and position yourself to be able to handle a wide range of potential outcomes.
Are any of those potential outcomes things that might deter you from, say, the South African picture, that might leave you a little less optimistic around the SA picture? I mean, I've been speaking to a couple of analysts and fund managers around just, are there outcomes that would lead you to be negative on South Africa?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the one would be the NHI there to see, I mean, how one's able to fund that is going to require a lot more detailed studies and analysis there. So it's going to be important to see where one has some tougher decisions, the medium-term budget coming out, to see how they're going to plan to fund some of the future requirements and expenditure. So it's going to see all tough decisions and trade-offs made.
Mike, looking at the rest of the year, obviously there's a couple of things, like you alluded to, around the US elections that might be keeping markets a bit volatile. And from a PSG point of view, you have a bit of a longer term point of view, looking beyond the noise and looking beyond the short term kind of volatility. Are we optimistic around just the global picture as it stands at the moment, understanding that optimism could potentially only materialize in 24 months from now?
I think, I mean, one's always got to be aware of the different risk factors. And I think it also shows the importance of being adequately diversified asset classes there. So, I mean, it's been overall, I think, fairly positive. I mean, the markets and that one's seen positive growth in that. But what one's also seeing is a trimming of interest rates, I mean, which will help certain businesses and companies there. So, I mean, there is always a level of uncertainty in markets. So I think it's being aware of those and being agile enough to be able to manage and monitor those type of events.
There's always going to be uncertainty in the markets. You just need to be prepared for it and make the necessary adjustments. I think we'll leave it at that, Mike. Thanks so much for the time and the insights. We wish you the best of luck for the second half of the year, and we look forward to catching up at the end of the year. That's Mike Smith, Chief Financial Officer at the PSG Financial Services business, joining us to reflect on how their first 6 months went and what they're looking forward to in the next 6 months.
There's an eerie feeling of calm before the storm in the crypto market. This is among the longest periods where Bitcoin has remained range-bound for so long. My name is Shivan Mudli. I'm the macro strategist at 88, and I will be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where I'll give my prediction on what is likely to happen next in the crypto market.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's another Thursday, it's another SME, and this SME has taken a very interesting approach to oral hygiene. I'm joined on the line by the founder of Freshmo, Paul Masilo, to take a look at what Freshmo Brands is and why he built the business. Good evening, Paul. Lovely to speak to you. Tell us about Freshmo.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Paul Masilo from a company called Freshmo Brands. We into the oral and personal hygiene industry. We manufacturing a mouthwash packaged in a sachet.
Paul, how does one go into mouthwashes?
I think that, you know, Freshmo was born out of fasting. You know, normally in January you undertake fasting as a Christian. You know, and then so I used to buy those non-brands. Their mouthwash and carry it in a bottle, you know, it's bottled. So it was always bulky for me. So the other day when I was looking for my mouthwash bottle, I actually found it sitting on top of a tomato sachet, the sachets that they give you on a takeaway. So that was the light bulb moment to say, why can't I put a mouthwash in a sachet so that it's convenient for me to carry around? Because I used to walk around the office, you know, carrying a bottle, you know, and it was very bulky, you know. Yeah, so that's how Freshmo was born.
I love when we solve problems for ourselves and just make the world a better place. Paul, how do you make a mouthwash? What goes into the ingredients, the manufacturing process? I mean, as a business as well, I mean, it's very easy to look at something like this as a solution and say, I'm going to buy a mouthwash and repackage it. What do you guys do?
Basically, what happens is, I don't have a background in chemical engineering. So when I had this light bulb moment, I had to approach Professor David Katerere, you know, who has got so much extensive experience in terms of the pharmaceutical products, developing pharmaceutical products. So we needed to have the correct ingredients and the correct measurements. So Professor David Katerere came into that space and helped us a lot to develop our formula from scratch. You know, we're looking at ingredients that would actually give you like clean breath, you know, fresher breath, you know, and all those things. So yeah, the experience of Professor David Katerere to get us the proper ingredients and the proper measurements was very key in developing our product.
Paul, tell me about your journey with the Aspen Gibbs Route to Market Challenge. I can imagine that would have been a very interesting thing to take part in this year. Tell me about that experience and what it taught you.
I was very honored, you know, because I think this is not taking me. Last year I tried to apply, but I wasn't successful. But this year, fortunate enough, I was accepted into the top five, you know. One of the key experiences that I benefited from the Aspen, you know, Aspen Route to Market program, very valuable, was actually the issue of looking at my strategy in terms of, because my sales were very low, you know, so the panel that was sitting on the Route to Market, included Alan from Race Corp, you know, and the management team from Aspen and, you know, from Gibbs. They did help me a lot to actually develop my strategy, you know, in terms of actually making more sales, you know. And one of the interesting things was actually they helped me to even shape up my opportunity that I had with a big retail, shop. you know, that Freshmo will be going into very soon. You know, they helped me to get some pointers, you know, key points that I needed, you know, with this retail. So, yeah, the Aspen route to market, you know, which I got through Razicorp, you know, has really been impactful to our business, you know, in a very short time. You know, imagine in a very short time, because I think I did the top five and top three within a space of a month or so, a month and 2 weeks. You know, so yeah, that strategy, really, that participation has been very key to help us, you know, shape our strategy in terms of approaching the retail space, because it's a complex space, the retail shop.
Sounds like things are moving at a very quick pace for you and your team, Paul. Take me through some of the challenges that you're still having. When you look at your business now, what do you still want to do? What do you still want to add to the business that you might not be able to do at this stage?
Actually, you know, King, access to market, you know, you cannot overemphasize it, you know, because it's a small business for us to grow, you know. And that's the part, you know, that we gained from the advice that we got from Aspen, actually help us to fulfill one of our objectives, which was to put Freshmo into Africa, you know. So the advice that I got, you know, from the Aspen route to market panel, you know, helped me a lot, you know, to define the strategy to go into Africa, you know. I've already been to Zimbabwe, trying to export into Zimbabwe, and very soon we'll be making some interesting announcements, you know, around Freshmo and Africa and into that space, you know. So some of the challenges are access to market. Obviously, when you expand into Africa, you know, when you do your export, you would need funding, you know. Yeah, so those two, access to market and funding, are very crucial. But also funding, it depends, you know, from my definition, you know, it's not necessarily money. Sometimes some funding can come in the form of the things that you need. Like, for example, you know, somebody will come in with the logistics that we need to use to take a fresh more into Africa, you know. So that's, I classify that as funding, you know. Yeah.
Paul, what's the next dream for the business? What's the next thing you want to do in terms of growing the business and taking it to the next level?
The biggest dream for me will always remain. I want fresh more products to be in the 52 African countries, because the fresh more is an African product. And it must be consumed and be used by Africans, because we developed whatever product that we develop at Freshmo, we develop it for African people, you know, people in our continent, you know. So the biggest dream I would say I would have achieved if I get Freshmo into 52 or 53 countries of Africa, then I would have achieved my dream.
I think it's actually 54 countries, but that's only one extra country to add there.
Yeah.
Paul,
so those 54 countries.
Most importantly, Paul, how do people get hold of your products? Where can people find you if they want to experience the product, if they want to get some Freshmo products? Where do people find you?
People can buy Freshmo direct from us on 068-675-1856. They can buy it direct from us, 068-675-1856, or they can buy it at Macro Marketplace, they can buy it at Take a Lot, they can buy it at Eden Vine. Eden Vine has got two shops in Manly and Randburg. They can also buy it at Medi-Q Pharmacy in Park Station. They can also buy it online. If they actually type Freshmo, you'll see all the list of the online shops that are there, like your pop shop, your Hive wholesalers. Yeah, there are quite a lot. Our live market, you know, there are quite a lot of them that, you know, are stockists of Freshmo. But there will be a big announcement very soon, which will actually put Freshmo into some huge retail network.
A big announcement is imminent and the business is continuing to grow. You've got to love to see a small business doing exceptionally well. And we wish you the best of luck, Paul. We wish you all of the successes in the world, and we look forward to seeing the business grow even bigger and hit all 54 of those countries on the African continent. That's Paul Masilo, who is the founder of Freshmo Brands, joining us for this week's SME. We've come to the end of our show. We've come to the end of another week. If you've missed any of our conversations throughout the week, they are are available online. You can go catch up on them. There have been some really good conversations from various companies and organizations. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.